You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Last week, the London Observer reported on a top-secret U.S. memo outlining plans for surveillance of United Nations delegates to gain an advantage in the debate over Iraq. The leaked National Security Agency document described aggressive surveillance of the home and office telephones of Security Council members expected to oppose the resolution, setting a deadline for Iraq's disarmament. Former government whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg said at a press conference Tuesday in Washington that global reaction to the report could land a devastating blow to U.S. efforts to gain approval for the resolution. Ellsberg is best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times in 1971, which were widely credited with helping to turn public opinion against the war in Vietnam. Speaking at the press conference, he called on other government officials to leak documents to Congress and to the press showing the Bush administration is lying in building its case against Saddam Hussein. Ellsberg said the story on spying at the UN is potentially more significant than the Pentagon Papers, and he faulted the U.S. media for downplaying it while the story gained headlines throughout the rest of the world.
This leak, which has been presented to the American public only by a few newspapers, a very brief mention in the Washington Post, to my knowledge, no mention one line yet to the New York Times, the paper of record. This leak, which is of immense interest when it came out and over the last week in other parts of the world, including Chile, one of the members of the UN Security Council, which was evidently bugged by the U.S., and Russia, Japan, Australia, France, and certainly England, headline news in all those countries has oddly, and I can't explain this, not been mentioned to the readers of the New York Times yet. So if Chile changes its vote to accord with the majority opinion in Chile against a war on the Security Council, I don't know how New York Times readers will understand that has happened, because certainly this evidence that they've been treated effectively contemptuously and arrogantly by the United States is very sensitive in Chile, whose government was overthrown by the United States in company with local people and by CIA dirty tricks under Richard Nixon. That's made them, let us say, quite sensitive to evidence like this. Bugging, of course, is understood to go on by all these countries. They probably all do it. But when they are very blasé about, this is not news. It is news, it seems, in the rest of the world. But when anyone says this is not news, they're ignoring, for example, the fact that the cable apparently makes clear that they're bugging the home phones of these officials as well as their offices, and that there is an intense surge on, so that the immediate significance of this, there's twofold. The content of the memo indicates that if there is a vote in favor of the U.S. Resolution here, the U.S.-British resolution in the U.N., it will not be a coalition of the willing, as Bush likes to call it, but a coalition of the coerced, the bugged, the bribed, as in the case of Turkey, which failed, a bribe that failed, it seems, against the people, the browbeaten. The clear intent of bugging the homes of these people is to get information with which to find their vulnerabilities, there to intimidate them directly, if possible, with information that they don't want known, private information of various sorts. And if they're terribly blasé about that, I can tell you that the NSC members, such as Morton Halpern and Tony Lake and others, who found very belatedly that their phones had been bugged by Henry Kissinger and the FBI for the president, were not all that knowing. These were not naive people. They had high clearances, but they had not taken it for granted that their family's conversations were being recorded over months and years. And that was quite a sensation, which in fact was a factor in the impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon. Perhaps we've all become very blasé since then. I've explained why I said the Pentagon Papers, I would say, was less timely, less significant in itself than this piece of current intelligence. There's several reasons. It's coming out before the bombs are falling with the intention of properly discrediting a policy that the intelligence people feel, and I was not an intelligence person, I was a policy analyst and staffer and an official in Vietnam later, but felt that it was a wrongful policy. I came to that belatedly, but after the bombs had been falling. So this had the potential then of properly changing votes in, for example, Chile, where this is a major issue, precisely because it would be hard for the Chilean government to stand in front of its people and say, we are opposing your will in voting with the U.S. purely on principle. We have not been subject to undue influence or intimidation or manipulation by the U.S. government. This cable raises that question and has been raised in those exact terms in Chile right now. A change in the vote in Chile and perhaps Mexico or one or two other countries could in turn have a ripple effect, as I saw it, this is just judgment on my part from my experience, a ripple effect on the willingness of France, China, and Russia to veto. That in turn has been said by Bush that that will not affect him. He apparently regards the Security Council as a kind of focus group, just as he regards the people in the street, 6 million of them, as a quite large focus group that he doesn't have to pay attention to. On the other hand, Blair, who's his only real ally in this, and again against the will of his own people, will find extreme hesitation of his people, including his party, but not only, to side with the U.S. against in the face of an absolute lack of authorization from the U.N., which may include both less than 9 votes in favor and 1, 2, or 3 vetoes, especially if there are 3 vetoes. So there could be a ripple effect here, which has a small possibility of splitting even Blair off from this vote. Bush can, of course, say that he'll go ahead anyway, but in turn we'll face now extreme reluctance on the part of the American people and skepticism about going it alone in a situation where our closest allies cannot be convinced of the appropriateness of what we're doing.
Former government whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg speaking at a Washington press conference. Thanks to Abishai Artsy for preparing that report. A Washington-based political action organization, Black Voices for Peace, organized a rally today to protest media coverage of the peace movement by the Washington Post. Tens of thousands of women from around the world descended on Washington over the weekend in celebration of International Women's Day and to denounce the Bush administration's policy on Iraq. They received very little coverage in the local paper. Peace Watch correspondent Selena Musata spoke with participants at the picket line in front of the headquarters of the Washington Post.
My name is Kathy, and I'm 44 today. Actually, it's my birthday. And I'm from Fredericksburg.
Okay. And I was wondering, why did you come to participate in this rally?
Because I was so disappointed at the coverage that Code Pink got in the Post.
What kind of coverage did Code Pink receive?
It was like the bottom of the page. It started, and it was on the metro section. It was like there were all these people that came from so far away, and people came from all over. It was the first time I'd gone to a protest. And people were there from all over the United States. And the coverage that we received in the Post, it was ridiculous. I could not believe that there was hardly anything in there. So, when I got the email mentioning that they were going to protest the coverage that the Washington Post has given, I said, this is something that needs to be done, because obviously the Post isn't aware that, there are people. And, a lot of the people that were at the Code Pink rally were people, the people I met were people that, are protesting for the first time, And, there are a lot of people who are concerned about this. They're concerned about this thing of the United States deciding to invade another country and take over, So that's why.
Like, what kind of role do you see yourself in this?
I just want to make my voice known that, I'm against, the Bush policies.
The name is Ross Purzel. I live in Falls Church, Virginia. And what else? My age, 52.
I was wondering, why did you come to this specific rally?
Well, first of all, because, I go to a lot of rallies since this madness has started, but this one because I understand it was called for by Black Voices for Peace. I wanted to show my solidarity specifically with that group, and I also agree with the aim of this protest here today, because the Washington Post really, despite the fact that they have a few courageous correspondents who will, between the lines, tell the truth, but if you look at their editorial page, they are, just as they did during the Reagan presidency and since then, they are really pushing for war in very unreasonable ways. They're really not allowing people like who share my point of view against the war to have a voice. So I think that we do need to protest that.
About 50 to 60 protesters turned out today for the lunchtime protests. Thanks to Selena Musata for that report. Today is the National Labor Day Against the War, and leaders from the nation's main farm labor organizations sent a letter to President George Bush expressing outrage over his, quote, heavy-handed tactics, unquote, against the Mexican government in an attempt to secure its agreement for a war against Iraq. We spoke with Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, which represents immigrant farm workers from Mexico and the U.S.
There's a very strong sentiment against the war. As you know, the labor movement has had its own problems because Bush's war is against not only Iraq, but also against labor unions, against women, against civil rights, against civil liberties. And so labor is having a really hard time just hanging in there.
Now, how do you make that extrapolation that this war is also against women, against education?
Well, I mean, it's right now, just in today's news here, you have in the San Joaquin Valley, these little towns where you have a lot of farm worker kids. One of the little towns, McFarland, which is a very small town, is having to fire, like, I believe, 20% of their teachers. You have up in Tehachapi area, they're firing 50 teachers. So they're getting laid off because of the whole budget crisis. This is directly affecting, of course, the children of farm workers who are having a hard enough time trying to get an education anyway, and then having all of these cuts when our money that, you know, everybody's bragging about this big bomb that they just detonated in Florida, the mother of all bombs. I think when they report that, they should also report how much does this bomb cost and how many teachers' salaries could that bomb pay.
Is the labor union unified in its opposition to the war, or is it not straight across the board?
Well, I would say in terms of United Farm Workers, there's no question that people are opposed. I can, of course, speak for other unions, but I would almost venture to say that any of the unions that have large numbers of people of color in their ranks are going to be against this war.
According to one Mexican diplomat, quote, any country that doesn't go along with the U.S. will be paying a very heavy price, unquote. What, in your opinion, would happen, Dolores Huerta, if Mexico doesn't vote in favor of a second U.N. resolution? What are the political and economic consequences?
Well, I don't think Mexico's gotten very much help from the United States in any respect anyway. I mean, they keep talking about the Mexico's economy, that it's, you know, gone up a lot. But the problem is that a lot of those the dollar signs are really American dollar signs because they're American companies. All of these maquiladoras or these sweatshops that they've established in Mexico. So it's really U.S. profits that are coming out of Mexico, and it's not really, you know, money. The Mexican people are just kind of wage earners right now, and sweatshop wages at that in the Mexican economy. It's not really Mexican money, you know, what's coming out of Mexico. So I don't really think, you know, Bush said he was going to do something about a legalization program for undocumented that are here in the United States, and that hasn't happened either. And, you know, Bush continues to insult the intelligence of not only the Mexicans in Mexico, but Mexican-Americans here by appointing this fellow, Miguel Estrada. He's nominated him to the appellate court there in D.C., the circuit court, where this man, who's, by the way, from Honduras, but he's totally against civil rights. He's against labor. He's against the environment. And he's against women's Roe versus Wade and all of the women's right to reproductive freedom. So I don't think that the Bush administration has shown itself in any way to even, you know, before this war on Iraq clamor, has ever shown himself to be a friend of the Latinos.
Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America. While around the country, high school students continue to make known their opposition to going to war in Iraq, today 1,400 students walked out of Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland. Peace Watch spoke with Doug Kelvin of World Youth Media, one of the organizers, about his participation in the walkout. He spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian.
Well, at 1 o'clock, I was down in the cafeteria, and people were literally pouring down the stairs into the cafeteria. There were tables set up with petitions to say no war. There were signs, and people just poured in. Then Isabel organized at the podium. Everybody sat down. There were a few speakers, and then people poured outside and down Spring Ridge Road to the intersection with Old Georgetown Road and then came back.
Describe how this was sort of sanctioned by the school administration, how this was organized.
Well, it was initiated by students, and the administration decided that they would support the day today, and classes were excused, and so people were able to skip class and attend this rally and walk out without fear of, you know, retaliation from the school. And that's very important. That's going on in several schools in the area. Some other schools have promised that they're going to get tough and threatening the suspension and other punishment for students. And examples like this one are very important to show that this is community service, but it is a national and international crisis, and that students need to take time from school not only to express themselves politically, but also to make a difference in stopping the war.
And speak about how this fits in the context of other protests. I know there's been throughout the, you know, Washington area and across the nation of students taking part in these sorts of protests.
D.C. high school students in particular have been in leadership positions in initiating walkout that students around the country have also been participating in. The first in Washington, D.C. happened in early January when over 100 students from Deal Middle School and Wilson High School walked out. Shortly thereafter, students in Montgomery County, Maryland formed the Montgomery County Students for Peace and Justice at the same time as students in D.C. were forming the D.C. Students for Peace and Justice. And now there's over 30 schools involved, all of which have participated in demonstrations, several which have had walkouts and die-ins and have protested. At Blair High School, they disrupted and protested Tom Ridd, the Homeland Security chief, when he came to speak at the school. Over 300 students walked out of the school that day. And, of course, March 5th was an international day of walkouts and student demonstrations around the world. The D.C. area, Northern Virginia, D.C., and Montgomery County and Prince George's County, the level of mobilization among teenagers in particular in high schools and middle schools, I think, is some of the most rapidly growing in the country.
Doug Kelvin of World Youth Media speaking from the Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland. He spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. While the Bush administration continues to pressure members of the UN Security Council for a vote to attack Iraq, the International Answer Coalition, Act Now to End War and Stop Racism, is calling for a global demonstration this Saturday in an emergency mobilization to stop the war. At a press conference today in Washington, representatives of Answer outlined the plans for this weekend's rally and march to surround the White House, while former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark detailed a campaign to impeach President Bush. Mara Verheiden-Hilliard is a lawyer with the Partnership for Civil Justice on the steering committee of Answer.
Once again, the people of the United States and people around the world are coming out into the streets to demand that this administration not wage a unilateral war of aggression and cause a needless slaughter of people in the Middle East and escalate a cycle of violence. The government has for months tried to degrade this movement, tried to dismiss this movement, tried to call the organizers of the anti-war movement fringe groups, tried to call them focus groups. And the reality is, this is a movement that cannot be denied, that cannot be ignored, that has held back the Bush administration from its desire to wage first strike vicious war in the Middle East. And most importantly, this is a movement that reflects the depth and breadth of America. This is a movement of people from all backgrounds and all walks of life. It is people coming together from the women's movement, from the civil rights movement, from the religious community, from the lesbian, gay, bi, trans community, from all sectors fighting together because we oppose a war in Iraq. And we oppose this administration's war drive, its quest for empire, its efforts to dominate the Middle East. And we do not believe that the sons and daughters of America should be sent to kill and to be killed because this administration wants to conquer the oil of Iraq and set up a strategic foothold. We have with us today a number of very important speakers who will be addressing this demonstration this weekend, March 15th on Saturday, when tens of thousands of people will be coming out into the streets of Washington, D.C., meeting at the Washington Monument at noon on Saturday. There will also be actions in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and in cities around the world. Our next speaker is Mahdi Bray. He is the executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation.
In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, I am happy to be here again and again and again with the Answers Coalition in what we call the People's Quest for Justice and Peace. It's completely clear that the American people are not in lockstep with this president against the war. When I look at Iraq, I think about Vietnam, and I see deja vu all over again. I was involved in the anti-war movement in terms of Vietnam. Today, I am happy to say that unlike the Vietnam era, where the religious community took 3 years after the Gulf of Tonkin deception before the religious community actually coalesced and came together to speak in a loud, resounding voice against the war. In this case, the majority of the American religious community is opposed to this war now and have been from the very day it was on the table. I call your attention to what was never publicized in the press, but a much-held hearing that Congressman Danny Davis held at the Rayburn House building, where every major religious denomination, the National Council of Churches, Council of Catholic Bishops, and even the president's own denomination, United Methodist Bishops, where they are saying that they were opposed to this war. And even our good friends, the Episcopalians, mind you, said if this nation went to war, that they indeed would come out and acts of civil disobedience. We are bitterly opposed to the concept that we can impose democracy through regime change in Iraq, a democracy that we find somewhat wanting as Muslims and in the Arab community right here at home in terms of our own civil rights and civil liberties right here. I think charity does indeed start at home, Bush. There are a lot of work that we need to do right here. You need to look at maybe doing some things here with Ashcroft as it relates to our community. We say this to President Bush because he once said that his greatest philosopher was Jesus the Christ. So we would remind him that Jesus the Christ didn't say, blessed are the oil barons or blessed are the warmongers. He said, blessed are the peacemakers. Jesus the Christ said, what profits an individual if they gain the world and lose their soul? So with that admonition, I would leave and challenge President George Bush on the spiritual planes of saying that, George Bush, indeed, your arms are too short to box with God. For the love of God, stop this madness.
Our next speaker is former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He is, as you all know, the foremost U.S. political leader that has documented the catastrophic result of the sanctions placed on the civilians of Iraq and has fought to end those genocidal sanctions.
The Constitution says that the President, the Vice President, and other civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office upon impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. The United States needs to return to the Constitution, which, not fortuitously, but from painful experience, addressed precisely the question of what do a free people do when a despotic executive, monarch or president or by any other name, usurps power, disregards popular will, and engages in unacceptable and criminal acts. It's imperative that the American people speak out on the issue of impeachment. If they want to take back the Constitution, the Bill of Rights has been shredded. held up for contempt. 14 months, people at Guantanamo held, nobody knows their names. Nobody knows what's happening to them. We saw one guy carried out on a stretcher from interrogation in the paper the other day. Do you think international law permits that? Do you think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights permits that? Do you think the International Covenant on Civil Political Rights permits that? Absolutely not. And if they did, they'd be trash, wouldn't they? You can't hold a person for 14 months, no charge, no trial, no nothing. You don't even tell their mothers where they are. And here in the United States, no president has been charged with crimes that compare in their horror or in their seriousness in international and domestic law with the crimes with which President George Bush must be charged. War of aggression. That's the first offense under Nuremberg, a crime against peace. It's imperative that we take back the Constitution. I hope everyone who can hear this will look at the website, www.votetoimpeach.org, and if having studied it, there's 18 pages of history and definition and background material, 10 indictable offenses, which are also impeachable offenses, set forth. Vote. Act now. Saturday may be the last chance the American people have to stand up and say no. And if they say it loud enough, they can stop the president. The power is in the people. That's a sociological truth.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Thanks to Rada Lewis from D.C. Radio Co-op and Reem Kathuda for preparing that report. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad, Bentha Berklin, Mita Patel, Reem Kathuda, John Hamilton, and Angelique Shofar. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.